Richard Flanagan has been travelling all over the world. Ever since his novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, was awarded the Booker Prize, Richard's life has been a world of planes and foreign cities and the international media asking him impertinent questions. Then, just as Richard was looking forward to some peace and solitude and to settling back into his writer's shack in Tasmania, Richard got a call from World Vision, the international charity organisation. World Vision were asking him to go and witness something momentous: the vast exodus of people from Syria into refugee camps around the Mediterranean, and then to write something about it. Richard agreed, unsure of what he was going to see when he got there. And as he began to appreciate the scale of what he was witnessing, the multitude of personal tragedies within it, he struggled to find words to capture what he'd seen. But eventually he did find the words, and Richard wrote a long piece for The Guardian that was printed all over the world. Welcome back, Richard.
That's good to be back, Richard.
You were looking forward to a nice long sleep in after going all over the world, much hailed and feted, as rightly so, of course. And then World Vision contacted you. Do you remember what that phone call was like? What were they proposing?
Well, I had a long talk with Tim Costello. They felt they were having a lot of trouble in getting the message out about what was happening to refugees from Syria, that there was a weariness about it, that people had disengaged from the issue. And because they were on the ground and recognised how extraordinary, how vast and how important it was, that they were desperate to try and find ways of alerting people to it. And they asked if I would go and write something about it. I actually didn't think I could achieve very much because the limits to what you can do as a writer. And I said I didn't want to go there as part of any sort of media circus. I just wanted to go there and meet these people, and then I would try and write simply about the people I met. I wasn't interested in the politics, the history, the religion. I just wanted to, I said, all I can do is tell a few stories and perhaps, you know, that might do some good, because it is my experience again and again that people have a hunger for truth, and it's a hunger that's as real as our hunger for food, for sex, for all sorts of things. But truth matters to people. They need it like food. And if you can try and do your work honestly enough, and with a measure of humility, that truth does end up being heard. And so I thought I could possibly do that. But having said that, I didn't really want to go because I was back here in Tasmania. I wanted to write, I wanted to finish a novel. This was a lot of time out, and I felt unequal to it. I didn't really know if I'd be able to do what they hoped I might be able to do. And then I thought about it, and I thought of my friend Ben Quilty, and I thought, if he came with me, perhaps together we might be able to do something that might help a little.
This is the artist, Ben Quilty. Yeah, he's been on this program too. What happened when you rang him up? How keen was he to go with you to the Mediterranean to see this exodus?
Well, Ben's a wonderful enthusiast, and so I rang Ben and I said, look, I don't think I really want to go. I don't think I can really achieve much, but they've contacted me and this is the proposal, but, you know, I don't really have time and so on. But I did think maybe if I did it, I'd do it with you. What do you think? He said, I'm in. I said, but I don't think I really want to go, Ben. I not really. He said, I'm there, Flano. He's very excited about it.
You rang him to ask him to go with you, but he talked you into it, in other words.
He never talked me into it. He just never assumed that it wasn't going to happen once I made the call. And I hung up and I realised that although I was still completely undecided whether I could achieve anything or whether I'd go, it was going to happen because Ben had decided it was. And so that was really the start of it.
Well, since we're talking about Ben and art, let's go for the broad brush before we get into the little finer brushstrokes here on the scale of this. Give me your understanding, Richard, about the scale of this exodus, how you see it in terms, you know, historical terms, the sheer size of this outflowing of people.
Well, it's astonishing when you actually witness it. I mean, it's commonly described as the greatest humanitarian disaster since, well, the greatest refugee disaster since World War II. You're talking about a country with a similar population to Australia. And out of that 22, 23 million people, I think 11 million people are displaced, by which I understand to mean they're no longer living in the home they were living in at the beginning of the war 5 years ago. And out of that 11 million people, perhaps about 6 million have actually left the country. So that's like all of Sydney and more vanishing out of Australia. It's extraordinary. And then when you're on the ground in Lebanon, in Greece and Serbia, and you just see thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people and more coming every day. In the last 3 months, 140,000 people have crossed from Turkey into Greece. 140,000. I mean, these are just extraordinary numbers. And they keep coming because their country has been destroyed. That they're fleeing because they're starving. They're fleeing because 50% of hospitals have been destroyed. They're fleeing because the most basic services don't exist. I met people for whom it became an extraordinary act of courage to get out of the rubble of whatever ruin they were living in to try and find somewhere where they might be able to get nappies for their babies or medicine for an ageing parent or just some sort of food that they might eat that evening. Everything had become a monumental struggle.
You said it, Ruan, just before you came in, you were telling me how it struck you as being a lot like, in some ways, a terrible natural disaster, what these people have suffered, like some tsunami or some dreadful cyclone or something like that. Tell me how you see that comparison.
Well, as an Australian, I think, firstly, we view these people through the reportage from the media, which is painted in abstract terms of politics and current affairs and so on. But it is like the mega fires and huge floods that we experience, and we understand what that does to people. We understand that once a fire takes hold, there's not much we can do about it. But we also understand we can help those people. The people of Syria have been suffering a mega fire, not for one day of the year, but for every day of the year for the last 5 years. And they've literally fled for their lives for the same reason people end up living in shelters after a bushfire.
So they were like people who had to just, they were going about their normal lives and they had to just drop everything and run like that.
Yeah, at a certain point, sometimes, you know, their towns have just become battle zones. Sometimes they hang in, you know, and they keep on trying to go about the small matter, but completely necessary matter of daily life. And then there inevitably comes a point when someone is dying or their children are starving or their house has been blown up or their children murdered or their children are reaching an age when ISIS might want to recruit them. Or there's, I met one child who's 15 whose father had been with the Assad regime's army. He'd been captured by the Syrian Free Army and then released. When he went back to the Assad regime's army, they executed him anyway because they thought the fact that he'd been released must mean that he was a traitor. I mean, they're those sort of moments when people just realise they can't go on. I met a policeman from Raqqa, and when his house was blown up by a Russian bomb, he realised there was no future any longer for him and his family. And yet the extraordinary thing with these people I met is that we have this vanity in the West of thinking they want to come and have our life and our material wealth and so on. So many of these people I met all want to go back to Syria. They have a profound love for their country. And when you hear about the towns they're from, Basuta, Raqqa, on and on and on, these are often towns where there's been human civilization going back 6,000-7,000 years. They're profoundly old communities and they have a very strong attachment to the place, to their particular form of family life, sometimes to their larger tribes and so on. It's that they want to resume. You meet the children and ask them what they want to do. They want to be often engineers or teachers because they want to go back and rebuild Syria, if you ask them why. So there's, we misunderstand these people thinking they're wanting our world. They just simply want their world back.
They're not going to get it back, though, are they? It's wrecked.
Well, I should say about that. I mean, they understand it's wrecked far better than we do. They've lived in the wreckage, and they still want to go back. I mean, of course, some don't, you know, but the great majority I met do. Most of them, we're talking about the scale of it. You're talking about Lebanon, which is a country of 4.5 million people. Tiny landmass, 17,000 square kilometres. That's like the east coast of Tasmania. And in that country of 4.5 million are now 1.5 million Syrian refugees. And one of the reasons they're there is it's right next door to Syria. And the moment they can go back, they will go back.
So they took you to a place called the Bekaa Valley, near the border of Syria, in Lebanon. What's this place like during winter?
I found it extraordinarily sad. It's a very fertile region of flatlands ringed by great mountains. And the mountains were always covered with thick snow. It was brutally cold. Blizzards frequently blew in. Occasionally you'd see the sun rolling like a severed head towards Syria. And in this essentially rural valley, the one crop that's sprouting everywhere are these endless shanty towns of the most primitive hovels and tents, which are made out of plastics, bags and planks. And in those are living about 500,000 of the poorest Syrian refugees. You go into these little tents and hovels and the people are always very frightened that they'll blow down in the next big wind or that the blizzard will come and they'll collapse. They leak, they're freezing. The aid agencies get little heaters, these little cast iron boxes about the size of a beer carton, and that's the only warmth they have. And in them they burn whatever scraps of wood they can find, melamine, chipboards, things like that, things that, you know, are full of carcinogens and heavy metals. But the alternative is hypothermia. Having painted a sort of dismal picture of these places, and you when you walk in, you know, there's thick mud everywhere, there's no services. But you go into their tents and they have that extraordinary Arabic tradition of hospitality and welcome of a guest. And these are people who've had everything taken from them, and they found what remains is some bedrock of dignity. I found them very beautiful people, and I was extraordinarily moved by the grace and dignity with which they met me. When I'm saying they're people with nothing, I met a 13-year-old girl who was being married off, which is not their custom to marry children off that young because a family couldn't afford to feed her. I met a 6-year-old boy who used to walk 2 kilometres each day to the nearest sort of grocery store in a nearby village and collect scraps of vegetables off the ground out the back, bring them back, and his family would boil them up for lunch. A 9-year-old boy working as a welder 7 days a week for $5 a week. The sadness and the despair of these lives is overwhelming. And yet in the tents, there was this transcendent grace about these people. And it became, for both Ben and I, the most extraordinary honour to be allowed in. I won a prize and I had to go, of all things, to Buckingham Palace to meet the Queen. An odd experience. And I had this half-hour private audience with the Queen. The honour of being invited into these flimsy shelters made of bags and planks was for me far, far greater than being asked at Buckingham Palace.
Is there a lot of boredom in that camp, aside from the kind of ongoing terror on a day-to-day basis? Because there doesn't sound like there's much work to be had.
In Lebanon, in Jordan, in Turkey, they're not allowed to work. The government doesn't allow it. Of course, there's a black economy. In Lebanon, though, the black economy really only works in summer when there's workers, rural labourers, and in winter there's virtually nothing. So the people have got, they've only got aid to survive on. If they're able to register as a refugee, which is a complex process, they're entitled to $5 a week, and it's on that that they live. I would say I was impressed by what the aid agencies do achieve. And without what they've done, into that, they managed to get basic sanitation into the camps, they managed to get basic food and medical aid, these people's lives would be far, far worse. There'd be epidemics of dysentery, cholera, diphtheria and so on. That help is essential. And at the moment, it's grossly underfunded. The governments, like the Australian governments, aren't meeting their fair share of the burden. And the aid agencies themselves could do with a lot more help from individual citizens.
You read about a woman you met called Ragda, who was a seamstress. What did she tell you her life was like before the war in Syria?
She was extraordinary. She wanted to be a fashion designer, and she was probably in her mid-20s. And she was from Raqqa, I think, from memory. And she said, because the thing that you go there with preconceptions, you go there with words like Muslim, terrorism, these things, people are so much more extraordinary than that. And people are never reducible to simple labels like that. And we met this woman who said to her that her tradition was colour. And she dressed, she loved fire colours because they were about rebirth. And she'd actually arrived, she'd fled to Lebanon only about 3 weeks before, and her child was born a week after that. And she called her child Sulaf, which means sunrise.
So she fled when she was heavily pregnant?
Yes.
And the child was born in the refugee camp?
Yeah.
And she's called this, it means sunrise.
Sunrise. And she loved fire colours. And because she worked with clothes, she ran the risk of being beheaded by ISIS because we all laughed. I mean, the absurdity of evil, because she worked with naked mannequins, and that's a crime punishable by death.
Oh God! The mannequin was offensive, and
the idea of a
naked death.
Yeah, I know, it's extraordinary.
You wrote that she said that the ISIS fighters, they weren't Arabs by and large. They weren't like from her country at all. They were. What did she say about them when they came into her area?
When we were talking earlier about bushfires and things like this, we experience bushfires as an inexplicable cataclysm, although we understand their reasons for them. Her experience of ISIS and so many refugees' experience of ISIS was like that. She said, this is how she described it to me. She said, they came suddenly upon us. We didn't know from where they came or who they were. They only spoke a few words of Arabic. They were Chechen. They were Chinese. They were Somalian. They were American. They were French. They were Afghan. They wore masks. And so many other people said similar things to me. Of course, there are many Syrians involved. But I think it goes to show the mistake of thinking a threat like ISIS is bound in one country, and if we just drop enough bombs on them, we'll destroy it. There are much more profound reasons why this culture of evil has appeal, you know, and we have to think much more broadly about it. And we must make sure, I think, that we don't create fertile grounds for it to recruit in, you know. And part of the answer to that, which I'd like to talk about later, is how we actually come to treat refugees and how a country like Australia views its responsibility towards refugees.
What did she and others have to say about the Islamism? I think it's a better way of putting it rather than the Islam, but the Islamism of the ISIS fighters in her area.
She, as I said, she loved fire colour. She dressed in colour. She loved clothes. And yet she was an observant Muslim. She felt, as so many other refugees said to me, that their Islam is not Islam, that they know their Islam. And what ISIS is about, in every sense, is not Islam. that they murder at will, that they have no morality, that as a Muslim, none of this made any sense to her. And she was very strong about this. Everyone was. These are people whose, as a Christian is a Christian, but also their mothers and fathers and daughters and sons, as they're also a person from a certain area and a certain culture, so too are all these Syrians. You know, that they're Muslims, but they also have a whole set of other beliefs. We are, as human beings, not reducible to one simple thing. We can be many things and true to all those things. Islam tries to, ISIS, I should say, tries to reduce the world to one perverted idea that it calls a religion and has nothing to do with that religion.
What were Ragda's living conditions like in that place where you found her?
Ragda had a tent made out of planks, polytarp and plastic bags. There were some rugs on the floor and a few cushions on which we sat. And unusually, she'd somehow got hold of a sewing machine. They borrowed money to buy it, and she'd started making dresses to try and make some money.
So there is an economy going on of sorts, even there.
There's, yeah. Of course, there's an economy, yeah. And it's people do what they must do in order to have food. There's many things going on, and some of these things are terrible things. I mean, people must do what they have to do.
As you said, she'd just given birth. How was she going taking care of her newborn baby?
Her husband that day had gone over the mountain pass to Beirut to try and find work. He'd been a roadworks contractor. She was there. She was with her baby and remarkably relaxed, you know, and the baby was very calm. And But it's very hard for parents there because there's a lot of sickness in the camps. They can't afford medicines. When she left hospital, she was given a list of medicines that she would need for herself and the baby. She could afford none of them.
She's still glad, despite the conditions being as bad as they are there in the Bekaa Valley for her and others as well. Is she still glad she left, nonetheless?
Of course, every refugee is glad to be out of Syria because at the end of it all, it's a choice between life and death.
It sounds like she still kept, even there, she still had some kind of glamour about her. She still maintained a little bit of that about her. That was seemed like important to her.
She was glamorous, and that's where I mean that we, I think, and more so in Australia, we've allowed ourselves to be seduced by such nonsense about how other human beings are and think other human beings can be reduced to caricatures. Every person I met in these camps was an extraordinary, rich and varied human being. And there were such riches in each of them. And none of them reduced to a category.
You were there, as you say, with your friend Ben Quilty, the artist. How did he connect with Ragda after meeting her?
Well, Ben was a wonderful companion to have because he would come. These camps, as you were saying, they're boring. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge boredom for the people living there. So the moment you go into a tent, a lot of other people start coming in, other members of the family, the clan, the tribe, and the shanty towns tend to be built around those relationships and connections. And Ben took paper and pencils. He would do sketches of the people, but he would also draw with the children and get them to draw pictures. And that really helped me an enormous amount because it established a connection with the children and the women. And immediately, you know, we seemed much less alien and people opened up to us more. Interestingly and quite extraordinarily, when Ben would get the children to draw, when they drew Syria, they would always draw, they would just reach for the black and blue and brown pencils. They only drew it as darkness. And they would only use, the only colour they would use would be red for blood. And they would draw, there was a little girl, the most beautiful child, about 6 years old, we met in a Serbian transit station called Hiba. And she drew the most extraordinary picture of a helicopter gunship dropping barrel bombs on these broken bodies. And I said to her father, has she seen these things? And he said, they've all seen these things. That's all they see.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
I'm with author Richard Flanagan, the author of the Booker Prize-winning novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. Richard was getting settled in, ready to write his next novel when he got a call from World Vision, the international charitable organisation, which invited him to go to various places around the Mediterranean to witness the exodus of people from Syria, to see how they were getting on, to be a witness and to write some words about it. He wrote some words about it for The Guardian. It was printed all over the world. We were just talking about Ben Quilty, who you went with, the artist. Now, amazingly, you ran into Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist, while you were there going around these places. Tell me about your encounter with him, Richard.
Ai Weiwei was on Lesbos, and he's a lovely man. And I remember we had this talk one day about literature, because his father was a poet and the difficulties of it. And that little girl, Heba, who I was talking about before, I had a photograph of the picture she'd drawn of the barrel bombing, and I showed it to Weiwei, and he said to me, he looked at it for some time, and then he turned to me and he said, what more is there for people like us to say? And I understood then how utterly genuine he is. You know, he's very, you know, he doesn't have to do this. You don't have Jeff Koons on Lesbos. He's set up a studio there, and he's, you know, trying to alert the world to what's going on. Because until you see, we're talking about the scale of it, and I conveyed it badly early on, but you get this island of Lesbos where hundreds of thousands of people have passed through. This island's not much bigger than Bruny Island. And when you're flying in, you look out the plane window, there's this orange rind along the coastline, and it is thousands upon thousands upon thousands of life jackets that have been abandoned by refugees coming across on the people smugglers' boats. And then you get down on these rocks and they're just piled up everywhere, and they're just all these torn old boats everywhere. It's the most extraordinary thing to see.
This is the hardest story I think you had to tell or try to tell while you were in Lesbos. It was the story of a family of a woman called Yasmin, her husband Idris. They were living in an apartment on Lesbos with, I think it's Yasmin's father, Ramadan. Tell me about meeting them and their family and what they told you about why they needed to leave and the actual process of leaving Syria, getting on the coast and going into the waters of the Aegean Sea.
Wow, this is terrible. It upsets me thinking about it, really. It was a Sunday night on Lesbos in the main town of Mytilene. It's very cold when we were there. I mean, it was maximum about 2 degrees Celsius. And we went to meet this large family, the patriarch of which was a carpenter called Ramadan, a Kurdish family from the town of Basuta, another very ancient town. And 2 days before, his daughter, Yasmin's son, Ramo, had drowned in the Aegean when they were trying to come across. The family had decided as a family they had to flee Syria. They said they talked about it for days and days, and in the end they were starving and they couldn't feed their children. And they thought it was better to die drowning than to die of starvation and shelling. And as it turned out, they did lose one of their own, this 4-year-old boy, Ramo. Everyone remembers that terrible photograph of Alan Kurdi, the Syrian boy whose broken body lies like jetsam on a Turkish beach. But people don't realise that 2 children are drowning every day coming across. 350 people are drowned just in the last 3 months trying to make this crossing. they told me about their journey. So they're these cheap black rubber pontoon boats, and you pay for a seat in them. And the boats would take, they're a pretty standard design, they'd probably take 20 to 30 people vaguely safely.
And are you paying for a seat to a people smuggler or an aid agency?
To a people smuggler.
Right.
Yeah. It's a complete racket. It's about €1,000 a seat. These are very poor people often, and they've been robbed all along the way by people smugglers to get to this Turkish shore where they'll now get this boat. €1,000 a seat. And when they get there, there can be up to 80 people jammed on these boats. So the freeboard sinks to about a hand width. And the price goes down when the seas become choppy and people are more likely to die. So then you can get a seat for €500. So if you've got a family, you have to make this calculation about when you'll travel, which is a very cruel choice that's visited on each of these people trying to make this crossing. So Ramadan's family got on this boat. I think there were 60 on his boat, he said. And the family in this cold little apartment in Mytilene, they described what it was like on the boat, how they were on top of one another. Yasmin had a pregnant sister. She had people sitting on top of her.
Well, they acted that out in front of you, did they?
They showed me, yeah. It was night. It was freezing. It was snowing down. We were there the day after he drowned. I mean, there was snow almost down to sea level. As they were coming across, they held their children above their heads so they wouldn't get... If they got down into the middle of the boat, they'd be in the water and they could be crushed to death. So the parents are holding their children above them. And at some point, a rescue boat from Mytilene came out. And the rescue boat inadvertently rammed the refugee's boat and ruptured a pontoon. So the boat started sinking. Now, these are not people who have any experience of the sea, you know. They know nothing of it. Some of them had never even seen the sea before. And when they were telling me this, I tried to imagine the panic. And then you think you can't imagine the panic of 60 people desperately trying to save themselves in the dark. They all fell into the sea, tumbled into the sea, I suppose, as people were trying to rescue them. And then they realised they didn't know where little Ramo was. And I understood I had to just try and bear witness to what I was hearing. And I realised I had to ask questions, and very difficult questions. How did they find Ramo? What did he look like? But I couldn't ask them. And this poor woman and her husband, Yasmin, and her husband was called Edris. They sat in this middle of the room, to their enormous credit, and they tried to answer my questions, but they were so lost, and they were so, you understood that they'd buried their child the day before, and the day before that, the night before that, he drowned, and they were not there. They were still on the boat. You could see them still searching the dark sea, still trying to understand why or how this had come to be. And then Ramadan, the father, said, he said a thing, quite extraordinary thing. He said, "We lost one, but we survived." And that might sound callous, but I think I understood it not to be. He was trying to say, we ran this risk for all our sakes, and this has happened to us, but we will go on as a family. And I'd imagine, like all families, they're riven by jealousies and enmities as well as united by love and compassion. But the courage of it was extraordinary.
They were sold life jackets by the people smugglers at $50 a piece. What happened to those life jackets?
The life jackets are so... That's what did for Ben and I. We got down on the coast. It actually been earlier that afternoon. And it's just these, as I was saying, just this endless orange jetsam, this orange rind around the island of these life jackets. And they're a standard, very standardised thing that the people smugglers sell to all the refugees, and we got one, and I smashed it apart with a rock. It had quite a tough nylon. They looked like a real life jacket. And then I pulled out the foam inside, and it's not a proper buoyancy foam. It's just that cheap packing foam you use for, you know, you'll see ceramics packed in. And I put it into the sea. It was like into the Aegean, and I squeezed drops of the Aegean out. It was just like a sponge. So these poor people, most of whom can't swim, fall into that freezing water. And they would have had one round Ramo. And it's not a life jacket, it's a death jacket. And I couldn't believe that people would sell these things. That they were selling things that they're not just fakes, that they kill. They kill. And then I found on the beach, and I brought it home, I should have brought it in to show you, a little life jacket, which is just like a little set of floaties, just a little inflatable thing we'd put on a kid, on a toddler to play with. And it's just something you'd buy for $2 or $3. And that was lying on the beach, and I realised some child, all that stood between it and death was this little inflatable life jacket. And that upset me more than anything.
It seems like we're now in the similar kind of territory as our last conversation, Richard, about your novel and the experience of your father and other men like him during the building of the Thai Burma Railway. That kind of... maybe we're not... I don't know, maybe it's a different thing.
I think it's a much worse thing because...
It's cruelty here. Is it cruelty, or is it just a sheer lack of indifference? What is this anyway?
There's several things. The experience of the Australian POWs was one where they didn't lose their home or their family. That always existed, and they always understood if they could survive, they'd return to it. They never felt their country had abandoned them or their people had abandoned them. And they didn't think the world had abandoned them. And the moment they were found, food came, help came. There was a huge effort to get them out. That isn't necessarily what many of these people are experiencing, but it is what they should be experiencing. And they should be experiencing it because I came to understand when I was there, if there's one answer the world must make to the evil of ISIS, it is to help these people, because ISIS wants Muslims around the world to feel that they're reviled and rejected. And the strongest indication the world could make of that is to treat these people as less than human beings. ISIS has this idea of the grey zone. They do not want that. It's in their teachings that there's a grey zone where the West lives, where there's all sorts of values. And their stated aim is to destroy the grey zone. But the grey zone is where we help each other as human beings. The grey zone is where we respect other people for having different religions and different values, and we live together in harmony. And we can't let ISIS destroy that grey zone. If Australia was to match dollar for dollar the amount of money it spent dropping bombs on Syria last year with its aid to Syrian refugees, it would increase its aid to Syrian refugees tenfold. And there's so much more we can do as a country. In the time that Canada has resettled 26,000 people, we've resettled less than 30. The Australians I know are a large people, a good people, a kind-hearted people. There's a lot of talk about the refugee problem. I don't see it. I see a politician problem. I see people who have no morality or no ethics beyond their own advancement. And I think we should demand of them that we start recognising human beings as human beings, and not let them run this razor wire down the hearts of our nation. That's what I think should happen.
It's interesting what you say about ISIS and their view of the grey zone and their intentions to destroy it. It seems that that's their stated intention, that they perceive that multiculturalism that exists in many places in the West, and places like Australia, that world where non-Muslims can coexist quite happily alongside Muslim people, they see that as a strength that they want to attack. They see that as a kind of a strength. I don't know if we always see it that way, do we?
No, I think we're allowing people in our own worlds to see it as a weakness. You've had the rise of Trump, the terrifying rise of Trump, in America. In Europe, interestingly, the forces that espouse the language of violence and division and exclusion and hatred like Trump, the far-right parties, the anti-migration and anti-refugee groupings, are being supported by, of all people, Putin and Russia. He's channeling money into them. He's using the internet to create, support for them. So it's clear to me that we do have great strengths and that there are many people who want to destroy them, and it's time we recognise them for the virtues they are, the richness they are, because there is goodness in them, and we need that. We need that to go on. You know, the world's it is in some ways in a powerless place, and we have strengths and we can and must speak up for them.
World Vision took you to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, to the island of Lesbos in the Aegean, where many of these refugees have sailed in treacherous conditions to arrive at. They also took you to Serbia, to a transit station for Syrian refugees on the Croatian border. That's where you wrote you saw a long line of shuffling refugees. It looked like history in the making to you. Where were they headed? Where were they going? What were they wanting to do, Richard?
Well, they were heading to Germany, and they were going through the route that in the last couple of weeks has closed off. But that route went up through Croatia, through Slovenia, and then into Austria and Germany. And that moved me because I have a photograph in my writing room, and it's of my three daughters, taken about 10 years ago, of a pass in Slovenia through which a mountain, alpine pass, through which these refugees would have to travel through. People like Yasmin, who lost Ramo, like Ragda, and so on. And that's the same pass my children's grandparents fled across in 1958 from communist Yugoslavia as refugees. My wife, Maida, was conceived in an Austrian refugee camp south of Klagenfurt in 1958. And so when I see this river of people coming out of Syria, this great exodus of our age, and I see that river pass up through Europe, I see my own family. And as you said at the beginning, I don't see these people as like you and us. I see them as us. And I think that there is no other time to help these people. We only have now. And it matters as human beings, and it matters for our future, that we do so much more.
As you say this, I'm sort of inclined to think that really all so many Australians, like people like me and you, as like your wife, Maida, we're all the product of some kind of forced exile at some point in the family line, going far back enough, aren't we?
Yeah, Australia is, a contemporary Australia, was born out of rupture. And we, more than most, should see in these people ourselves. And we should see them the way we see people after bushfires, as people who we can help and do an enormous amount for. You don't have to have an understanding of the Syrian war, of Middle Eastern politics, of the strange bizarreness of world geopolitics, to know that there's much we can do, and it is for the good. And that's what Australians do when they see people suffering, and that's what they can do for these people. A small amount of money will make a great difference. I saw it. I saw it, and I saw it.
You were in Paris just before you went to Lebanon, and this would have been around about the same time, or just in the aftermath of the Bataclan bombing that was going on. What was the atmosphere like? What did you observe while you were there?
Well, this is the other aspect, I guess. I mean, it was not like the Paris I knew. It was there was fear, and there was a fear not just about another attack, but how Europe might hold together. Just the short, I was in the publishing district, and the hotel I was in, I think, was empty for 3 of the 7 days I was there. You know, I was on first name terms with everyone because I had nothing to do. And I would walk, you know, about 5 minutes to my publishers, and up this little lovely little side street, you'd suddenly come across 3 very heavily armed soldiers with big, big guns. And they were guarding a little Jewish school there. Now, of course, they should, but it's a terrible thing to witness the world having come to that. And a journalist was interviewing me, and they were, you know, she was, you know, a broad-minded, tolerant woman, but she said, what is France to do? What are we to do about all this, about terrorism, about refugees? And I think that's the question that haunts Europe. And it's very difficult because Europe is conceived in response to their own experience, like Syria, the horror that beset Europe in World War II. It's an attempt to make sure that horror never returns. And yet now countries are turning on each other at the very moment they need to be coming together to address this crisis. And again, in all that, I think if other countries beyond Europe show some enlightened attitude, if we give more money to refugees, if we take in some more refugees, again, that helps Europe, and the stability of Europe is critical for the stability of the world.
Those children you met who were hoping with their families to have some life in a place like Germany, what kind of a future do you see for them once they get to Germany?
The kids were lovely, you know. But I felt a sadness because they're going to a world where many people will treat them. These are people who've fled the horror of Daesh, as they all call them, who've witnessed their sadism and their wickedness, and now they will be treated themselves. They will be called terrorists. They will be reviled as the very thing they risked their lives to flee so that they might have a future. And in all that, they'll carry this great trauma. So it matters enormously that these people are greeted with compassion and with understanding of that profound trauma as its victims, not as its perpetrators.
You can go back to writing your novel now, which must be, I don't know, is that a relief? Or and is this thing going to creep around your imagination or your sleepless nights? How's this playing out in your mind right now, Richard?
I'm a little haunted by it, but this article is going to be published as a book later this year. Ben's doing some wonderful things. He's got an exhibition coming up at the Art Gallery of South Australia later this year, and he's actually working with Ragda, the woman you talked about earlier, the dressmaker from the Becker Valley, to create an installation there. There'll be other things happening in consequence. But, you can't experience something like this and it not change a little about what you think about things and how you see the world. But it made me, above all, I should say, just grateful for my own friends and family, because again and again you realised these things can come to any of us, and what remains is the love others have for us and the love we have for them. That's the bedrock of us as human beings.
I was talking to George Megalogenis recently, and George suspects, that Australia's remarkable run of good fortune in the last 30 years or so, economically speaking, has, funny enough, made us a bit timid and made a bit frightened. Like now we want to kind of hang on to what we have and closed us off a little bit mentally from the rest of the world. What do you think?
I think the last 20 years we've become a smaller, meaner, more conformist people. And yet when you meet us as individuals, we're large and brave. And I think we should demand more of our public figures, and we should demand more of those who claim to speak for us in public life to reflect that largeness of what we are as Australians. Because we're better than them. We're so much better than them. And they need to rise to what Australians are.
Fascinating to speak with you about this, Richard. Thank you for coming back on the show once again.
Well, thank you.
On
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's easy and it's free. Go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You can donate to the World Vision Syria Crisis Appeal through World Vision's website. That's worldvision.com.au. And we'll put a link for that up on our own website, abc.net.au/conversations. That website again for World Vision is just simply worldvision.com.au. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.